Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right. Well, welcome back. And it is now or never, and it's content, content, content. We will do Feedback Friday. Excuse me. We'll be doing Feedback Friday on Friday, of course, because that's why we call it Feedback Friday. Next Wednesday, a week from today, we will be doing the national call for those of you who we're already working with, or for those of you who are interested in getting started in your state. The only thing you need to do to get involved in the national call is send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. You can also call. The phone number is 425-270-5416. And we kind of give you that number at the beginning of each, you know, coming back from each break. But anyway, if you're interested, then all I need to know is, what is it that you need to know? What is it you want me to provide you? And or any questions you may have for the group, or comments, and or what have you, and you'll become a part of the call. But anywho, without any further ado, let's dive in some content, because we left off with the Rhode Island ratification debates yesterday, kind of wrapped that all up, and now we're diving into the first, and this was literally the first debate that was formed, and this is the first vigorous debate. But it's kind of interesting when you read the debates, the ratification debates of Pennsylvania, you'll find that it does not include the anti-federalist comments. And I liked the way they did that, just due to the fact that the vernacular, the verbiage that was accepted was what you read. In other words, when they finally and ultimately decided to accept the Constitution and ratified it and became a party to the compact, the words that were provided that you're going to read are the words that helped everybody cross the finish line, or enough of the people to cross the finish line to actually ratify the Constitution. And so as they exhausted themselves in trying the anti-federalists, because there were anti-federalists in Pennsylvania. Again, Pennsylvania was one of the most heated debates of the constitutional ratification debates. New York was kind of tame because Alexander Hamilton was playing his games. I think Virginia was probably the most heated, because there were points in time where people thought there was going to be a duel. But anyway, the Pennsylvania debates did not disappoint for those people who were really looking for, you know, hair to be pulled and fur to fly. But we'd have no visibility to that because they didn't provide that as their final document of the ratification debates. And so what's kind of interesting is that they've set up the rules. But before I even dive into the rules, what I want to do is introduce Paul Venable again. Hey, Paul, welcome back. And are you ready to dive into Pennsylvania?
Yeah, GR, let's do it. Thank you again, and I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. So, folks, if you notice on page 3, Paul, and I just want to point this out, I'm not going to go through these, but it's interesting that they actually publish the rules that they all decided to go by, you know. And as a matter of fact, there a couple of things that I'll just point out. Is it was requested as soon as the debates began by Mr. McKean that the doors of the convention be opened. In other words, so that the public could actually come in and hear what these men are saying. And so they would have a peanut gallery, you know, because actually that was common in Congress as well, at least for the House of Representatives, that they always had the gallery where the people sit in the balconies and can kind of overhear. The requirement was you just needed to be quiet so that, you know, you didn't distract the members on the floor. But anyway.
Yeah, it's the gallery. And typically you'll see that in legislatures today. I was at my legislature recently.
That's
a common thing that you'll see now. Different than the original debates of 1787, which they locked the doors and they were in supreme secrecy.
Oh, absolutely.
Once it got out to the states, it is good to see that Pennsylvania wanted the people to participate or at least observe what was going on.
Right. Now, so one of the other things I wanted to point out is that there, it was number six, no member be referred to in debate by name. In other words, if you're making a comment back, you're not to refer to whomever you're talking to so that they wouldn't be able to allude to who that person was or what have you. So in other words, you couldn't call somebody out. But it's interesting, you'll notice that they do identify who is speaking. And during the Virginia ratification debates, I remember they always talked about the honorable member last up. Well, all you had to do was go look at the log and that was Patrick Henry. But anyway, in addition to this, you know, the president would, if you called somebody out, then the president would basically admonish you. And if you did it twice, they would name you by name for violating the rules. Anyway, it's kind of funny. And I just, if you're looking to set up a decorum and you know, you're going to have a group and you want to use either Robert rules or some kind of decorum, look through some of these rules that they came up with. Some of them are kind of, that's interesting. And it's, I'll just leave it at that.
On that note, let me ask you a question, then we can get away from the rules.
Sure.
You know, these days, most of us use Robert's rules, but in those days, I think there was something called Jefferson's rules. Are you familiar with those?
If they were called Jefferson's rules, those are probably the rules that he designed for the Senate, because as the vice president, the very first vice president, it was left to the president pro tem to determine the decorum of the Senate.
Okay.
And so that's probably what that's referring to. I don't know. Right. It's almost like, you know, the gallery is a balcony or it's an elevated floor and seating area for people to observe. And I don't know for a fact, but it's duly or aptly named the Peanut Gallery, or at least that's what, you know, when I hear the context of Peanut Gallery, that's what I think of, is, you know, the comments coming from the, you know, the people that don't know or what have you. Anyway.
Sure.
Does that make sense? Okay. So I don't know if that's the real connotation of the origin of the Peanut Gallery, but that's what comes to my mind. Anyway, so what we have in the Pennsylvania debates is Mr. James Wilson does most all of the comments. Now, there's a Mr. McCain that also comes up with comments as well. And so we'll get to those and we'll identify who it is. But predominantly, the majority of all of the oration in explaining the Constitution to the delegates at the convention, most all of them came from Mr. Wilson. And so I guess he had a good set of lungs and he had a pretty well lubricated whistle, I guess. But anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to start off with Monday, November 26th. And this is Mr. Wilson, and he's going to be covering some delegated powers and so forth. And so do you have that part, Paul?
I do. Is that where, hang on, am I on mute? No, I'm not on mute.
No. Before the revolution. Is
that before the revolution? I've got it.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a long paragraph.
It is.
Ooh. It's too long.
It is. Okay. So actually, just go ahead and read, and I'll interrupt you because we got about 2.5 minutes before the first break. So go ahead.
Okay, here we go. Before the revolution, many of the kings claimed to reign by divine right and others by hereditary right. And even at the revolution, nothing further was effected or attempted than the recognition of certain parts of an original contract, from Blackstone, page 233, supposed at some former remote period to have been made between the king and the people. A contract seems to exclude rather than to imply delegated power. The judges of Great Britain are appointed by the crown. The judicial authority, therefore, does not depend upon representation, even in its most remote degree. Does representation prevail in the legislative department of the British government? Even here it does not predominate, though it may serve as a check. The legislature consists of three branches, the king, the lords, and the commons. Of these, only the latter are supposed by the Constitution to represent the authority of the people. This short analysis clearly shows to what a narrow corner of the British Constitution the principle of representation is confined. I believe it does not extend farther, if so far, in any other government in Europe. For the American states were reserved the glory and the happiness of diffusing this vital principle throughout the constituent parts of the government. Representation is the chain of communication between the people and those to whom they have committed the exercise of the powers of government. This chain may consist of one or more links, but in all cases, it should be sufficiently strong and discernible. So that's the first paragraph. You want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going. We got 1 minute.
Okay. To be left without guide or precedent was not the only difficulty in which the convention were involved. By proposing to their constituents a plan of a Confederate Republic, they found themselves embarrassed with another of peculiar delicacy and importance. I mean that of drawing a proper line between the national government and the governments of the several states. It was easy to discover a proper and satisfactory principle on the subject. Whatever object of government is confined in its operation and effects within the bounds of a particular state, should be considered as belonging to the government of that state. Whatever object of government extends in its operation and effects beyond the bounds of a particular state should be considered as belonging to the government of the United States.
Okay, so we can stop right there because there's still a good body left and we're just literally running out of time right now. And so at this point, folks, as you can see, Mr. Wilson is kind of laying out the difference between the United States government and the British government, which everybody was pretty well aware of. And as he even talked about, the two parts of Parliament, the Commons and the aristocracy, or what they called the Lords. Anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me do this, Paul. I'll go ahead and finish, because what I'd like to do is cover the sentence before, and then I'll just finish off this paragraph, and then I'll let you pick it up on the next day of Mr. Wilson's comments. But anyway, this is what he said, what Paul had just read. Whatever object of government is confined in its operations and effects within the bounds of a particular state should be considered as belonging to the government of that state. Whatever object of government extends in its operations or effects beyond the bounds of a particular state should be considered as belonging to the government of the United States. But though this principle be sound and satisfactory, its application to particular cases would be accompanied with much difficulty because in its application, room must be allowed for great discretionary latitude of the construction of the principle in order to lessen or remove the difficulty arising from the discretionary construction on the subject. An enumeration of particular instances in which the discretion, which the application of the principle ought to take place, has been attempted with much industry and case. It is only in mathematical science that
industry and care.
Oh,
yeah, you said industry and case.
Oh, industry and care. You're right. It is. Okay. Only in mathematical science that a line can be described with mathematical precision, but I flatter myself that upon the strictest of investigation, the enumeration will be found to be safe and unexceptionable and accurate, too, in a great degree as accuracy can be expected in a subject of this nature. Particulars under this head will be more properly explained when we descend to the minute view of the enumeration which is made in the proposed Constitution. In other words, he basically created a general view that things that extended beyond the boundary of a state belong to the United States, but then he corrected it and said, but that only is applied by the enumerated powers, because he was referring to the enumerated objects in the proposed Constitution. And so, just to be clear, folks, everything that operates within a state is left to the state, period. There is nothing to be construed that the federal government has any reason whatsoever based in this Constitution on anything that belongs within that state except for forts, magazines, and those types of properties and needful buildings that are enumerated within the Constitution. That is it. And so I think the way he kind of started helping people understand in a very general term, he was kind of laying the groundwork of diving into the enumerations. And on the next day, Wednesday the 28th, that's exactly what he started off with, was the enumerations. And are you there? We're on page 16.
We have remarked, correct?
I cannot say, Mr. President.
Oh, okay. Hang on just a minute. Page 16.
Yeah, it's the enumerated subtab, if you're using the navigation.
I see it. There it is. Got it. Okay, there it is. I cannot say, Mr. President. Here we go. I cannot say, Mr. President, what were the reasons of every member of that convention for not adding a Bill of Rights? I believe the truth is that such an idea never entered the mind of many of them. I do not recollect to have heard the subject mentioned till within about 3 days of the time of our rising, and even then, there's no direct motion offered for anything of the kind. I may be mistaken in this, but as far as my memory serves me, I believe it was the case. A proposition to adopt a measure that would have supposed that we were throwing into the general government every power not expressly reserved by the people would have been spurned at, in that house, with the greatest indignation. Even in a single government, if the powers of the people rest on the same establishment as is expressed in this Constitution, a Bill of Rights is by no means a necessary measure. In a government possessed of enumerated powers, such a measure would be not only unnecessary, but preposterous and dangerous. Whence comes this notion that in the United States there is no security without a Bill of Rights? Have the citizens of South Carolina no security for their liberties? They have no Bill of Rights. Are the citizens of the eastern side of the Delaware less free or less secured in their liberties than those on the western side? The state of New Jersey has no Bill of Rights. The state of New York has no Bill of Rights. The states of Connecticut and Rhode Island have no Bill of Rights. I know not whether I have exactly enumerated the states who have not thought it necessary to add a Bill of Rights to their constitutions. But this enumeration, sir, will serve to show by experience as well as principle that even in single governments, a Bill of Rights is not an essential or necessary measure. But in a government consisting of enumerated powers, such as is proposed for the United States, a Bill of Rights would not only be unnecessary, but in my humble judgment, highly imprudent. In all societies, there are many powers and rights which cannot be particularly enumerated. A Bill of Rights annexed to a constitution is an enumeration of the powers reserved. If we attempt an enumeration, everything that is not enumerated is presumed to be given. The consequence is that an imperfect enumeration would throw all implied power into the scale of the government, and the rights of the people would be rendered incomplete. On the other end, an imperfect enumeration of the powers of government reserves all implied power to the people, and by that means the Constitution becomes incomplete. But of the two, it is much safer to run the risk on the side of the Constitution, for an omission in the enumeration of the powers of government is neither so dangerous nor important as an omission in the enumeration of the rights of the people.
Now, isn't that probably one of the best orations to explain the dangers of a Bill of Rights?
He really lays that out clearly, and in a time when they understood it. He clearly understood that the Constitution was a limited, delegated document.
Right.
If it's not the Constitution, that government can't do it.
Right. And so he was at the convention. And so, in other words, you know, when he was saying, I don't think anybody at the convention at all even thought of a Bill of Rights. We worked on what powers we were going to delegate. And that's all we did, is delegate very specific. And actually, it's not powers. They delegated roles, because the federal government has specific roles. They have the role and responsibility to admit states into the union. That's not a power. They don't have the power to choose. It's a responsibility. And so, but they don't have any power to dictate on the sovereignty of a state, or to determine, you know, well, we're going to make this state less sovereign because we're going to take some of its land away. They don't have that power. It's not delegated, nor is it enumerated. And so this is why, when we really look at the Constitution, the powers, they reference the powers to be listed in Article 1, Section 8. Those are the enumerated powers. Everything else is pretty much roles and responsibilities. Now, when you read, like, the 10th Amendment Center went through the Constitution and they listed all of the powers, and they listed as a part of the powers responsibilities and or roles that the federal government had a responsibility to fulfill, when it really isn't a power. Does that make sense?
Sure does.
Okay, good. Good. And so, When they sat down, and, you know, it's interesting, because it's only in this light, because I can't think of anywhere else where they, you know, somebody was talking about the convention, because he clearly says that he didn't even think it was on anybody's mind of a Bill of Rights. That it only came up to them as necessary, or it was only, you know, was a topic 3 days before this particular ratification debate. You know, of a sudden the anti-federalists started saying, oh, well, we found a flaw. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights.
Well, Wilson is speaking with clarity because he was there, wasn't he?
That's right. Yes, he was. And what's also really interesting is he enumerates many of the states that do not have a Bill of Rights.
Right.
And so, you know, anyway.
Not only that, this is still fresh in his mind.
Right.
I mean, they finished with this in September of 1787.
Right.
And Pennsylvania is meeting in November. So they were pretty quick to take this up.
That's right. Yes, they were. As a matter of fact, if you really think about it, you know, the 17th of September in Philadelphia is when they finished. And I believe it was just a matter of a couple of days because Continental Congress, I believe at that time, was also in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. I don't think right. It was up in New York. In the first session of Congress and the federal government's first meeting was up in New York. I think the first couple of years they were up there, and then they moved back down to Philadelphia because at this point in time they didn't have a seat. You know, the District of Columbia hadn't been identified yet. But the point is once it got to Continental Congress, then Continental Congress took maybe a day or two to make the copies of the Constitution. And then they sent it out to each of the states, and then each state had to make copies. So here's an interesting little tidbit that Pennsylvania was the only state that actually printed the Constitution in other languages, and German was one of those languages because there was a lot of Germans in Pennsylvania.
So well, that is interesting. I didn't know that, but it makes sense because it was, there was right. a strong German.
Sir. Right. And at that point in time, they didn't standardize language, but underneath the Constitution. And as new states joined the Union, that became one of the requirements, that a certain percentage of the population had to speak English. And that became very important as the states that had the Spaniards and Mexicans, you know, like California and so forth, they made sure that they were, you know, Christian, not Catholic. Anyway, we're in a break right now, Paul. So the heartbreak has just hit us. When we come back, we will start with the amendment comment on that same day by Mr. Wilson. So, folks, we'll be right back after this promo. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're back, and actually, I'm going to go ahead and read this. It's a small fragment. But what's important about this, and I'll kind of give you a little precursor, this right here talks about the suffrage, equal suffrage of the Senate. And so, go ahead.
Where are you? Are you an amendment?
I'm on the amendment, This is on page 19.
Got it. Okay.
And so, folks, you know what? I haven't put these up yet, but I'll get these up today. So you can, if you want to, you can go to the Red State Radio podcast page. Yeah, the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And I will have right underneath the links to the ratification debates, I will put this version of the Pennsylvania debates that we're using. So if you want to download this and read through these things, that way you're using the same. So when we reference pages and that type of stuff. And by the way, I've gone through. The only thing I've really done in editing these is I have formatted them. In other words, I've identified headings and then subheadings that I've added into it, like amendment here. And so I haven't touched anything else. You'll notice that there's some in the Virginia and some of the other debates, there are footnotes where, you know, these little brackets with numbers. I've deleted some of the brackets and numbers because it just becomes confusing when you're trying to read it. You know, like Blackstone, page 233. And so anyway, let me go ahead and read this. And he says, let us proceed now to the second branch of the legislative department. In the system before you, the senator, sir, those tyrants that are to devour the legislatures of the states are to be chosen by the state legislators themselves. Need anything more be said on this subject? So far as the principle of each state's retaining the power of self-preservation from being weakened or endangered by the general government, that the convention went further, perhaps, than was strictly proper in order to secure it. For in this branch of the legislature, each state, without regard to its importance, is entitled to an equal vote. And that the articles respecting amendments of this Constitution, it is provided, quote, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Does it appear, then, that provision for the continuance of the state governments was neglected in framing this Constitution? On the contrary, it was a favorite object in the convention to secure them. Now, he then goes on to talk about the Electoral College. And folks, you know, I want to read this, but I would end up reading all of the Pennsylvania debates. And so I just wanted to, and the reason why this is important and the reason why I added this is because of the 17th Amendment. Now, let me ask you a question now that I've read this, Paul. Is it not clear that the 17th Amendment violates this clause?
Absolutely. This, what he describes here, is a stake in the heart of the 17th Amendment.
There you go.
Because when they, and I think when they put this amendment together, they were pretty sloppy because they didn't recognize this clause in, I believe it was Article 5.
Yes.
That no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Right.
And the, I think the brilliance of this bicameral legislature, where the people are represented by their representatives and the states are represented by their senators, I don't know that anything like that had ever been done before.
No, but academically, the way he explained this, that there was a direct tie to the state legislators and their senators, that they were their suffrage. They were their representation, not the representation of the people. So, you know, I have that article that talks about rescinding the 17th Amendment. This citation is not in that article, which now just basically cattle prodded me right in the middle of my back. I need to pull that article in and add this one citation, because this is the best explanation that ties the symbiotic relationship between the state's senators, or I should say the senators in the U.S. Senate, directly to their state legislatures. There's a symbiotic relationship that could not be taken away, that no amendment can take away a state's equal suffrage without their consent. So in other words, folks, the seven states that rejected the 17th Amendment are not obligated to send, to have general elections to appoint their senators. And so I've talked to a lot of different constitutionalists, and even Dr. Vile, when I talked to him about this, he says, you know what, this would be interesting, but he said that it was kind of always ambiguous, that nobody ever tied this, you know, this relationship between the state legislatures. Everybody just kind of looked at it generally as the state. And now I have the golden egg.
Yes, you do. This is not ambiguous. And the other thing this shows is that for some reason, over time, the ratification debates were lost to the people. Hundred years.
Absolutely. Even academics did not use, most everybody used the Federalist Papers. And right. You won't find this type of detail in the Federalist Papers. It's basically just orations where, you know, people, Hamilton went down theory. I mean, there's some interesting stuff and it's insightful, but it's not nearly as detailed as the ratification debates. And so, as I read these things and as I find these golden nuggets, all of a sudden I have this epiphany, and that's what just happened today. So,
right.
Anyway,
well, I have offended some people by saying in comparison to the ratification debates, you can throw the Federalist Papers in the trash. It was pretty much a sales job for New York. These three writers were simply trying to convince the citizens of New York or the people who were involved in New York's debate, eventually the ratification, to buy the Constitution. And it's become kind of the go-to for everybody. And it's flawed. I won't say that it's flawed. It's like you said, theoretical. But the real meat is what happened in the ratification debates, because that's where they did the definitions. That's where representatives of the states made the arguments that eventually ratified the Constitution.
Right. And so this next paragraph that you're going to read is about the regulate and taxation. One of the things I'm just going to point out real quick before you read this is, if you notice almost towards the very bottom, there is a highlighted word that's misspelled. And so I don't change misspelled words, by the way, folks. And so what you see here is an NOI. I'm not sure if you see that, but there is a word that's actually should be not NOI. That I should be a T, but when people are reading and they're, you know, taking things off of OCR, you know, off these records that were written and so forth, there's these typos. And so some of these typos didn't get caught. And actually, the way they spelt words back in those days are considered typos as well. And I don't change those things. But go ahead, Paul, and start off with this: but I believe this doctrine.
Okay. But I believe this doctrine is a very disagreeable one to some of the state governments. All the object that will furnish an increase of revenue are eagerly seized by them. Perhaps this will lead to the reason why a state government, when she was obliged to pay only about an eighth part of the loan office certificates, should voluntarily undertake the payment of about one-third part of them. This part of taxation will be regulated in the general government upon equitable principles. No state can have more than her just proportion to discharge. No longer will government be obliged to assign her funds for the payment of debts she does not owe. Another objection has been taken that the judicial powers are coextensive with the objects of the national government. As far as I can understand, the idea of magistracy in every government, this seems to be a proper arrangement. The judicial department is considered as a part of the executive authority of government. Now, I have no idea that the authority should be restricted so as not to be able to perform its functions with full effect. I would not have the legislature sit to make laws which cannot be executed. It is not meant here that the law shall be a dead letter. It is meant that they shall be carefully and duly considered before they are enacted, and that then they shall be honestly and faithfully executed. This observation naturally leads to a more particular consideration of the government before us. In order, sir, to give permanency, stability, and security to any government, I conceive it of essential importance that its legislature should be restrained, that there should not be only be what I call a passive, but an active power over it. For of all kinds of despotism, this is the most dreadful and the most difficult to be corrected. With how much contempt have we seen the authority of the people treated by the legislature of this state, and how often have we seen it making laws in one session that have been repealed the next, either on account of the fluctuation of party or their own impropriety.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing that, you know, jumps out as you read that, and it is this what we call a passive. And so that actually misspelled word, as we got to that, this jumped out because he's talking about, you know, how the judiciary is what we call passive, but an active power over it. And I'm actually looking at, you know, the concept of the oath of office and the concept of support. And I am tying this relationship, because now we've got our hard break, in perfect timing, I guess. But I look at the requirement of support is to be not passive, but an active power that is supposed to be exerted by all people who are under oath to support the Constitution while they're in office. So anyway, folks, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're now heading down a little bit further. Oh, by the way, this is Saturday. So the convention was meeting on Saturday. I didn't point this out, but you know, they obviously considered their work week 6 days.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and today we have somebody from liberal California that wants to actually give the federal government the power to make a 4-day work week.
And then what?
Well, then it'll be 32 hours that, you know, they can only require you work 32 hours out of the day. I mean,
well, that's not in the delegated enumerated powers.
Correct. But what it also does is it makes it harder for people to get by. I mean, it will crush our economy if they went down this path. I mean, literally, it will crush us because now, you know, the 50s and 60s, because of inflation and getting away from the gold standard, that's when inflation really started rearing its head to where mothers had to start leaving the home to have a second income into the household to be able to get ahead. Now we're – go ahead.
Right. And that leads to something else. I was in a campaign event one day, and they're talking about more money for childcare. And I had the nerve to say, child care isn't the issue, is it? When you tax people so much that fathers and mothers have to leave their home and then leave their child care to strangers, you can't pay people enough to do as parents what you would do for your children.
Right, right. We need to restore single-income households.
Correct.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so, jumping ahead, or moving forward, because this is our last segment, we're now hitting a comment where he's talking a bit about the necessary and proper clause. And so we're down on page 25. So if you want to go ahead and dive into this one short paragraph.
Sure, I know. You know, we're having so much fun. These commercial breaks just kind of catch up with us, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Okay, here we go. The gentleman in opposition strongly insists that the general clause at the end of the eighth section gives to Congress a power of legislating generally. But I cannot conceive by what means he will render the words susceptible of that expansion. Can the words, quote, the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers, end quote, be capable of giving them general legislative power? I hope that is not meant to give give to Congress merely an elusive show of authority to deceive themselves or constituents any longer. On the contrary, I trust it is meant that they shall have the power of carrying into effect the laws which they shall make under the powers vested in them in this Constitution. In answer to the gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, on the subject of the press, I beg leave to make an observation. It is very true, sir, that this Constitution says nothing with regard to that subject, nor was it necessary, because it will be found that there is given to the general government no power whatsoever concerning it, and no law in pursuance of the Constitution can possibly be enacted to destroy that liberty.
So what he basically told them was that there was no general powers.
Correct.
And so what I'm doing is I'm actually making notes because, as I do this, and it's really great having you along, because as I do this, I'm able to make these, these additional headings and these other notes, because this concept of general powers is something that is nipping us in the backside all the time, because people literally accept the fact that the federal government has general powers when they don't. Now, the next comment or the next topic is amendments, and it's a short paragraph as well. So if you want to take that or you want me to.
Yep.
Go ahead.
No, I got it. I beg to make one remark on what one gentleman has said with respect to amendments being proposed to this Constitution. To whom are the convention to make report of such amendments? He tells you, to the present Congress, I do not wish to report to that body, the representatives only of the state governments. They may not be disposed to admit the people into a participation of their power. It has also been supposed that a wonderful unanimity subsists among those who are enemies to the proposed system. On this point, I also differ from the gentleman who made the observation. I have taken every pains in my power and read every publication I could meet with in order to gain information. And as far as I have been able to judge, the opposition is inconsiderable and inconsistent. Instead of agreeing in their objections, those who make them bring forward such as are diametrically opposite. On one hand, it is said that the representation in Congress is too small. On the other, it is said to be too numerous. Some think the authority of the Senate too great, some that of the House of Representatives, and some that of both. Others draw their fears from the powers of the president, and like the iron race of Cadmus, these opponents rise only to destroy each other. Jir, help understand what this guy is saying here.
So he's talking about the convention, because he says here, to whom are the convention to make report of such amendments? Because he's talking about amendments proposed to the Constitution, that the states can convene a convention. And then he says, but who are they supposed to report these amendments? And so these amendments are to go to Congress because it's under Congress. It still requires a full, because you got to remember that if a convention is formed with just two-thirds of the states, it doesn't go from the state conventions out to the states. It goes to Congress, and then Congress is then obligated to send those out to the rest of the states for ratification. But, you know, he's talking about, you know, the fact that there, you know, there's all of this, I'll just say, the complaints are in every direction, that the Senate is, you know, too small, that the House of Representatives is too small, it's too big, and so forth and so on, to where, you know, the naysayers are all complaining. And I think that they're talking about the fact that they couldn't get things done, and, you know, they couldn't actually get, you know, the work of the states and actually be able to do what they're supposed to do. And he's basically saying here that, you know, the Congress is more than adequate to receive those amendments and pass those out. Because bottom line, it still requires 3/4 of the states to ratify those amendments. Right. Now, so here's one of the things that I point out regarding the convention, that there is a good likelihood, let's say a convention, you know, is called for now.
Okay.
Right? Let's just say we hit the two-thirds in this legislative session. Then Congress would then call forth, because Congress would then tell the states to, you know, to have an election to choose your delegates to go to this convention. So in other words, I'm giving you a timeline of what would it take. Well, so When are elections done? Elections are done, we've standardized it to where elections are scheduled every November. So Congress has proposed that the elections, and then once the delegates have been chosen, then they can go off and make the amendments. Now, so this is really what could actually play out. The convention for the amendments to the Constitution, where the states would send their delegates, just like a constitutional convention,
right,
would happen a year after the fact. In other words, it would be the second year of a legislative session.
Correct.
So when all of a sudden these delegates come back and they provide, let's say, amendments that really, you know, scare the people, you know, sure, because the progressives have kind of seized control. What happens before the ratification? Because the amendments go back to Congress, and then Congress would then hold on to them and then send them out. Another election would likely take place before the ratification of these amendments. Does that make sense?
Well, sure. And then the other thing that happens is 3/4 of the states have to ratify.
Right. So actually, this actually happened. So for I believe it was the 16th Amendment, the state of Oregon actually bridged before they ratified, they voted out most of the progressives that were in the state legislature. And so when to basically ratify, to go into and not to ratify that amendment. Okay. And so the progressives that were in the state legislature, instead of actually seating these newly elected people to ratify, what they did was they said, you know what? We just ran out of time. But what they did was they basically held over the legislature from the last session because they called it old business that they ratified it. They violated their own constitution to ratify the 16th Amendment. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time. So we'll pick this up in comment in our next episode. Folks, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.